Welcome to Libromania, a new podcast for the book obsessed from the Close Reads Podcast Network. I'm David Kern. If you love books and all the things that make books great, this podcast is for you. Each week, I'll be presenting conversations with authors, designers, publishers, artists, biographers, critics, and scholars about the various things that make books worth celebrating. We'll be talking book design and bookstores, book printing and book collecting. We'll be talking about the lives and problems of famous authors and the science behind our love of books. We'll be chatting with working writers about their process and with scholars about the art of writing biography. This is chapter 4, in which I chat with three popular writers of middle grade fiction about their process, what a good writer looks like, how they know a story is finished, and much more. Those three writers are S.D. Smith, Douglas McKelvey, and Jonathan Rogers. Mr. Smith is the author of a series of adventure fantasy novels, The Green Ember, The Black Star of Kingston, Ember Falls, The Green Ember Book 2, The Last Archer, A Green Ember Story, and Ember Rising, which is The Green Ember Book 3. Douglas McKelvey is the author of The Angel Knew Papa and the Dog, a chapbook of poetry called Cattail, Fishscale, and Snakeskin, children's books like The Wishes of the Fish King, and has worked as a successful songwriter for many years. Jonathan Rogers is the author of the Wilder King trilogy, which is The Bark of the Bog Owl, The Secret of the Swamp King, and The Way of the Wilder King, and he's the author of The Charlatan's Boy, as well as nonfiction works like The World According to Narnia, St. Patrick, and The Terrible Speed of Mercy, a spiritual biography of Flannery O'Connor. One of the reasons this show exists is to discuss writing, the process, the anxieties, the problems, the joys of writing with working writers. And because these three friends write for a similar audience, it seemed like a good idea to have them on together. So we chatted at length recently about the writer's life and everything that means. Hope you enjoy. Here's S.D. Smith, Douglas McKelvey, and Jonathan Rogers. As for some of the things that I wanted to discuss, I wanted to have all three of you on because you're kind of writing for similar audiences, as far as I can tell. I mean, maybe your intended audiences are not, I guess, what is most easily called young adult literature. Would that be a fair sort of species of literature that we can throw that under for all three of you? Or is that, would you not consider yourself that way?
I think in terms of middle grade more than young adult.
Me too.
Okay.
Yeah. I think young adult implies some things that aren't true about what I write. Generally speaking, middle grade is feels much more accurate for me as well.
Yeah. It seems like YA has become a bit of a catch-all for like edgier sorts of topics being explored that probably none of us are, you know, a lot of agenda driven kind of stuff gets put under the YA.
I like that phrase, agenda driven, better than edgy, because edgy is complimentary.
Do you consider the concept of edginess as a positive thing, Jonathan? Is that something that you are consciously going after when you write?
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I meant that the term edgy, I don't know what I was saying. I hope nobody thinks of anything I write as edgy.
Well, okay. What do you mean when you say edgy? And I'd be curious to hear what you other guys think is on this as well. But Jonathan,
I think the word edgy gets used as a way of talking about not just topics, but the handling of topics that maybe expands our notion of what is, I don't know what the word is, normal or acceptable. And so I think there, Doug used the word agenda driven earlier. I think in a lot of young adult fiction, the agenda is to expand the realm of what we think of as being normal behavior or acceptable behavior. Or, I mean, I'm sounding like an old man here. I don't mean to, but that's when I say edgy, I think about, you know, moving to the edge of what's acceptable and then stepping an inch or two over it so that the next person comes along, steps an inch or two beyond that. And that's not something I'm especially interested in my own, you know, writing. I'm more interested in sort of inviting people back into a reality that is a good way to live. And so when you put it in terms of edgy or not edgy, that's a strange way to talk about it. It sounds like I'm somehow, you know, if you're not edgy, you're somehow afraid of, you know, pushing the envelope or something. There's also a way of pushing people back toward, well, I think most writers think they're pushing people toward reality, I think. And I'd be interested to hear what Doug and Sam have to say about that.
Yeah. Doug, what do you think about that? This concept of edginess?
Yeah, I think there are, I mean, I read a pretty wide variety of fiction. And, you know, sometimes I'll intentionally pick up a YA novel or some, you know, bestseller novel at the airport just to kind of keep tabs on what's out there. And there are certain books that as I start to read them, I have an instinctive aversion to. And I think it has to do with this kind of agenda-driven notion where I feel like almost like the writer has an agenda to sort of manipulate me into adopting maybe a certain set of beliefs that they have. Sam talks a lot about hospitality in his writing, that he wants to create a space with his writing of hospitality and welcome people into that and serve them through the stories that he's telling. And I think that's a really helpful paradigm, a helpful lens to look at the creation of stories through, because I think there are a lot of stories that kind of try to do the opposite, rather than being stories that exist in this hospitable space that welcomes you in. They have an agenda to push you to something else, to try to intentionally make you uncomfortable if you don't subscribe to whatever worldview they might be positing in their story world. And it begins to feel like propaganda, I think. And that's where the instinctive aversion kicks in. And I've always loved the George Orwell quote, "Propaganda lies even when it's telling the truth." And I think there's something about that. You know, you live long enough and you start to develop filters. I don't know, these little triggers that, you know, you're aware when someone is trying to manipulate you, whether it's through political sound bites or, you know, something that's being more subtly espoused through a film or a novel. So I agree with Jonathan's assessment of the word edgy and what that tends to mean and what it tends to occlude. You know, I think it's a word that covers up the fact that maybe there's a kind of a pushy agenda underneath something.
Sam, Doug just mentioned that you talk about hospitality. Do you see that as sort of an antidote to what they're talking about, this sort of propaganda-based literature, or do you see it as an entirely different paradigm altogether? Maybe both.
No, I can't. I feel like I'm not smart enough to sort of keep track of everything that's... I want to be a good student, and I want to pay attention to what's happened before in literature, and I like to read and think about things. But I feel like for me, I have to keep my vocation pretty simple. And as I want to just tell really good stories that aren't abusive or take advantage of kids, to sort of like what Doug was talking about, bringing sort of my own agenda. You know, Tolkien talked about sort of the allegory as like a purposeful domination of the reader by the author. And even though I'm sometimes accused of allegory, I do sort of see that as an accusation, because I don't do that. I don't want to do that. Not that there's not a place for that in some places. But I think that I do try to focus on very simply just telling a good story and being like Doug said, hospitable to kids. That doesn't mean, when you're hospitable to someone, doesn't always mean you give them exactly what they want. But it does mean you try to give them the best that you have for them, and something that you yourself enjoy. It's kind of got the golden rule mixed in there. And yeah, I in the same way as the other guys, like I have that sort of aversion to being like the this, it feels like the even the word edgy, I think Jonathan was saying that it feels like that's a compliment, and for a lot of people would consider that a compliment, but I feel the same way. Like, that does not interest me at all. Like, that doesn't feel hospitable. It doesn't feel kind. It doesn't feel, it's not even interesting. It feels tedious to me to think about, like, what edge are you talking about? It feels like there's an implied, like, it's like a transgressive sort of impulse. And I'm just not interested in that at all. I think that's boring. And it's not, and it's just, I don't think it's good on the virtue side of things, like the morality kind of a thing, which I care about, but it's also just boring on the storytelling side. I don't think, what's the point of, it's almost like I can't tell a good story, so I've got to be transgressive. I've got to be edgy. Or maybe you can, but it just feels like that's a different thing. And what's the point of that? That just feels like that's all about, like, how can I be interesting as an author, when it's much more interesting for a storyteller to disappear and let the story speak. And so I think that sort of transgressive, edgy impulse is just boring, and I don't want to have any part of it.
Do any of you, I guess Sam, you can go first on this. Do you ever find that you're sort of baser, less imaginative instincts in storytelling sort of drift that way, and then you have to correct them? Or is that something that's just so instinctively, sort of innately not a part of who you are that it's not even a temptation for you as you're kind of in the process of maybe writing a story at the beginning or a scene or something like that?
Well, I mean, to me, so this is because my particular little world of storytelling has so much to do with my own kids and the stories that I tell them, that to me, it feels like a vacation from my own, challenges with, thinking myself and the things that are temptations to me or problems for me. So I don't feel like I need to sort of like avert myself in those moments. It just feels like this sort of playground for a healthy imagination, because I'm thinking about them and thinking about serving them. And there's so many things in life, like when you're sort of focused on other people and especially kind of vulnerable people like your own children that you love, you sort of feels like the best, for me, the best instincts tend to kick in. And I don't feel like I'm battling like a desire to like make something, have characters grapple with something there. And my stories, there is some violence that can be a little bit intense. It's not gory or anything like that. I think it's still, but I don't want to say that there's no, heaviness or darkness. I think there is quite a bit, but I view that sort of within the purview of being hospitable to the kids because of the intensity of life and because of what kids are going to face. I do find myself sometimes thinking, well, what should I, but for me, I think it feels, I don't actually spend a whole lot of time worrying about sort of like content issues. It feels what I'm doing, whether it's good or bad, feels, pretty, I don't know, natural, or it feels like one thing follows the next. I don't spend a lot of time contemplating and worrying about that. So,
Jonathan, what about you on that question, on that front, what he's describing there? Do you worry about that at all, or do you just sort of?
Not really, to tell you the truth. That doesn't really enter into the equation for me. You've phrased it in terms of base instincts. Is that how you put it?
Well, I was kind of, yeah, I guess I was, you guys were kind of describing it as this negative, unimaginative sort of approach, or at least Sam sort of seemed to allude to that. So I was thinking, when you're in the process of writing a scene or a story, and maybe you don't have it fully fleshed out and you're just kind of working on it at first, is there an instinct, sort of a baser instinct, as you're sort of, you know, trying to get through a scene or something, that you kind of drift towards those things and then you have to correct yourself?
Yeah, no, I wouldn't say so. You know, that I've never thought, I could do something really, you know, crass here. Oh no, maybe I shouldn't do that. That doesn't really enter into the equation.
Doug, what about you? I mean, maybe we should just move on.
Well, no, I actually have a bit of a different answer. So, for me, I think it depends on what hat I'm wearing. I mean, if I'm writing something aimed at middle grade readers, then there's a certain tone and certain parameters, and the kind of dilemma or process that you're describing doesn't come into play. But there are times when I'm writing something And I guess part of my process as a writer is that I don't judge what I'm writing on the first pass, because no one is going to see that. And so often I don't know where a story is going. And so I'm in the middle of this scene as it's unfolding, and I'm kind of looking for my reference points and trying to get oriented within this story and who the characters are.
Yeah.
And so there are certainly times when I've followed, well, so there was, Jonathan and I both were invited to participate in the Wing Feather Tales story, or in the Wing Feather Tales collection of short stories. It was supposed to be short stories. And
mine was just done.
Yours was. No, yours was a poem. So neither of us fulfilled the requirement. But we were supposed to write short stories. Jonathan wrote a poem, and I wrote a novel-length story. But I probably had a dozen different iterations of that story as I tried to feel my way through it, because I began just following a character and had no idea what their journey was going to be. And in one of those iterations, the main character that I was writing about became very vindictively violent. And for a sustained period of the story. And, you know, as I was writing it, it felt right. And I finished that version of the story. And then I stepped back and started scratching my head and saying, this collection of stories is for families. you know, it's not for Cormac McCarthy's readership. So then I had to go back about halfway into that tale and start again and follow the character in a very different sort of direction, which ultimately turned out to be much more satisfying. And so I would say that, yes, there are times when, because I don't know where a story is going, that I'll follow it down a path. Whether I would describe it as giving in to baser instinct, I don't know if it's that.
Yeah.
I think the most pointed examples of when I've come up against that, though, were actually when I was dabbling in screenwriting and was in LA going through some screenwriting classes. Yeah. And you know, one of the writers there, who was also an instructor, but had been the showrunner for a major sitcom for a number of years, he said, if you're hired on a writing staff, you are being paid to have no filter on what you say. That in the writer's room, as they're brainstorming story ideas and throwing out potential lines for scripts and story ideas, you know, there is this sense in which they want you to have no filters in that brainstorming time, which I could never reconcile myself to, but there was certainly that tension being in that environment, where, you know, when I'm writing books, I can write that first draft and step back, evaluate it, completely rewrite parts of it, knowing that no one else is ever going to see the first draft. But yeah, there's a different dynamic apparently in Hollywood.
So Doug is the bad boy of the panel. Okay. We've established that.
I'm the edgy one.
Yeah, you're so edgy. You're pushing.
You are really edgy. I mean, it's the edginess.
Which means I'm boring.
Yeah, not only define that. Hey, so you guys are kind of all talking about something that I'm completely fascinated by. And I ask people this all the time. I ask this of poets, and I've asked it of screenwriters before, and even painters, but how do you know when what you're working on is right? How do you know, for example, that you're done? And Doug, you're just talking about how you're writing the story and you kind of followed this one version of the story and it took you down this particular path and it felt right. And then you get done and you look at it and you conclude that it's not right. And in that case, you're able to look at your audience and say, well, these people are not most likely reading Blood Meridian every Thursday with their kids. So probably not the best approach. But I mean, is it as simple as looking at your audience and saying, this is either appropriate or inappropriate for them? Or is there more to it than that? How do you know when you're on the right track? And Jonathan, I'll turn to you on that one first.
This might not be a complete answer, but it just has to be something that I like. I mean, you know, I never try to tell a joke that I think some kid might find funny, but I don't find funny. I mean, that never, ever works. So, you know, all the funny stuff in my book is there because I think it's funny. And you know, hopefully other people do too.
And you just happen to have a sense of humor that 10-year-olds drive with.
As it turns out, yeah.
what are the funny parts?
I don't know any other way to judge it except that do I like it? And also, I think one thing I was talking to one of my writing students about recently is the story has to surprise the writer. If it doesn't surprise the writer, it's not going to surprise the reader. And so I'm looking for something that is. Every time I write a story, I'm always have to be open to the possibility that I don't really know how it's going to end. Think I know how it's going to end, and I'm usually wrong about that. So I won't really start writing if I don't have an idea of where this thing is going. I get the feeling from Doug sometimes that maybe, Doug, you just launch into it and have no idea where it's going to go. And I can't really do that. I can't just go with no plan, but I also have to hold that plan very loosely because it always turns out that late in the process, I realize how this thing is going to, there's some surprising ending that comes to me. And I don't usually consider a story complete until that has happened. So it surprised me a little bit.
So that's kind of an indicator for you. If you haven't come across something that kind of surprises you or takes you, then you're not there yet.
Yeah. I mean, it's probably, if it doesn't surprise me, it's not going to surprise anybody else.
Doug, what do you think about that? I mean, how do you know when something's right?
A similar answer. I'm writing for that moment when the story gets away from me, when the characters begin to make choices that surprise me, that I didn't see coming until I reached that very moment in the process of writing. And this is probably a funny image to imagine me sitting alone in a room in my house, you know, trying to write through tears and sobbing, but that has happened to me several times in the writing of stories. And I agree with Jonathan that kind of moment is one where you suddenly realize this, there is something to this story, that it's taken on a life of its own, that it's gone a bit feral on you. And now you're just chasing it. Whereas before you were kind of trying to pull it along. Now you're just trying not to lose sight of it. And, you know, you're just following the path that it's blazing. And that's a very real thing for me when I'm writing, that if that magic moment doesn't happen, then I probably am going to end up with a manuscript that I'm going to set aside for several years.
And I was just going to ask that.
If I can figure out what's wrong.
Yeah.
And, you know, where the story went wrong.
Yeah. Sam, same with you?
No. Mine are just like, if it's completely predictable and it goes exactly as I have planned, and if it steps out of line for 1 second, then whip it back and shake.
You get
whip
back.
No,
you're as a writer.
Yeah, definitely. No, that rings true for me as well. I probably would not have been able to articulate that as well as those guys. Big surprise, but yeah, that's definitely the feeling. I have finished. I think Well, I've written three big books, I guess, in the Green Ember series. And I think my first one, I can just discount because it was, I didn't know what the heck I was doing. And it was just such a crazy period. But I think the second book, when I finished writing my first draft, I didn't like it that much. And I can remember getting feedback, and there was just something, I can't even really articulate what was wrong, but it wasn't. And I got some feedback from a really wise early reader that I trust a whole lot. And he gave me some specifics of what he thought, well, this isn't what worked because of this. And I think, you know, some of that was right, some of it was wrong, but anyway, somehow I was able to sort of like fix it. And then it was, oh, then it was okay. And I didn't know what was wrong, but I knew something was wrong. So it just didn't set right with me. And then the last book, I had a completely different experience with that. And I felt great about it the whole time. Like I felt this is really good. And it's my favorite book of mine, which may not be a super high standard, but, I really enjoyed it and I felt great about it. And it's funny how that has sort of, I feel like my instincts along those lines have been roughly pretty aligned with sort of the feedback I've gotten from the people who enjoy my books. They have that same kind of like, I don't know how to sort of name it. I wouldn't name it just as I wouldn't have said it's because of surprised. I wouldn't have said that. But when Jonathan describes it, I think, oh yeah, that's yeah. Yeah. And when Doug talks about sitting and crying through trying to write a scene, that I relate to both of those things, in a big way.
But the feral story part. No.
My beard is much less feral than Douglas's.
You know, when you start writing, you're writing under your own power and you're working out of the skills you have and the just the ideas that you have that you're aware of. And that's, you know, when I teach writing, that's kind of all you can teach is the skills and getting in touch with your own ideas. But then at some point in the process, if you are, you know, blessed, you start writing not out of your own, not under your own steam. If you hang in there long enough, it just, and as Doug has pointed out, sometimes that means putting it away and not coming back to it for a while. But eventually you're writing from somewhere beyond yourself. And I think this is true for not just for published writers. I think this is true for anybody who really sticks with it long enough. And that's really, I think that's what we're all talking about here is getting beyond your own steam and even beyond your own ideas. And when you're at the beginning, all you've got is your own ideas. And then somewhere along the line, something beyond your own ideas and your own talent kicks in.
I was going to ask if a question about, well, so can a writer be a good writer if he or she doesn't pursue that sort of sense of surprise? I mean, is that something you can, not maybe pursue is the wrong word, but if he or she isn't open to that? I mean, can you be a good writer and be very sort of rigid about your approach? I mean, are those two things possible at the same time? Doug, I'll ask you that one first.
I don't feel qualified to give a blanket answer to that because I would say with as many writers as there are, that almost certainly there That's are fair. Some who are writing compelling things without that being a part of their process. And now I've lost my train of thought.
Yeah. I mean, think about a journalist. I mean, people who are cranking out writing on deadlines, some of those people are brilliant writers and they're doing, you know, I think they have skills and talents that they can rely on day in, day out. And I think I don't think you can just say great writing or good, let's just say good writing, you know, requires, you certainly can develop the skills to crank out good writing day after day, you know, bloggers, somebody like, there are plenty of people in this world who crank out excellent writing day in, day out because they have acquired the habit and the skills. So I definitely think, David, there are people who write brilliantly under their own steam. I'm not sure in fiction writing, it'd be kind of hard to do that in fiction writing, I think.
Yeah. I guess that's the angle I was thinking. So is there a difference between what some people would call formula and what you guys are describing here? Like, can you write sort of according to a formula, like is common maybe in, I don't know, genre fiction or something, and then still have that sense of surprise? Or would you argue that the more formulaic you are in terms of sort of meeting certain beats and relying too much on archetypes, or at least relying a lot on certain archetypes, does that sort of eliminate the possibility or diminish the possibility of that sense of surprise for you? Sam, what do you think on that one?
I'm probably the least qualified to talk about sort of the world of fiction or writing, as far as I think that my own experience is pretty narrow in a lot of ways. I recently have co-wrote a screenplay, and I find that even in that, like, my partner had to be the one that was like, no, this is what you do in screenplays. Like, it has to be, you know, this has to happen in the first act, third act. We're sort of adapting my story to the constraints or the formula of the screenplay.
Yeah.
And I found that very difficult, but I sort of understand it. And I appreciate sort of the way audiences think through things and why something feels like it wouldn't work or would work. And I'm still a rookie in that world, but I don't particularly like that. I find that difficult. And so much of it is just instinct for me. Like, and I almost feel like it's, I have to, and if I think I want to keep learning, I want to pay attention to thing, you know, the craft, but I have to sort of rely on instinct a whole lot. And so when that's interrupted by sort of formulaic machinations, then I struggle with that big time. So I have to be pretty free. My experience so far is that I've enjoyed being pretty free of formulas when writing fiction myself.
Doug, you...
I was about to say, Doug's the person to ask, because he's between screenplays and writing radio hits. He knows about formula.
And he's edgy, too. He's super edgy.
So given that you're the expert and you're edgy, Doug, what do you think about that? I mean, formulas, obviously, I don't... Maybe it's even the wrong word, but it's a real thing that certain writers... as Jonathan even indicated with journalists and things like that, that they have to work, you have to work within the constraints of sometimes. So how does that impact that sense of surprise for you?
I think that there are definitely people who write from some kind of a formula, but who also leave enough breathing space in what they're doing that they're able to encounter some of those unexpected moments in the writing process. And I think that there are also people who write from a formula who there are some writers whose strongest gift is a feel for the language. Mm. There are other writers whose strongest gift is creating a story. There are books where the story is compelling, even though the writing might not be, as beautiful and poetic as you would hope, but you're still drawn in by the story itself. And so I think those, Jonathan and I have described how that moment of surprise when the story gets away from us kind of happens for us in the writing process. But I think of an acquaintance I have who has written a number of mystery novels. And he told me that he begins with an outline of the story and then begins to fill that outline in to the point that ultimately he has one sentence written for every paragraph that's going to be in the book, that his outline is that detailed, and then he fills it in. Wow. Which at first blush seems so formulaic that there would be no room for that kind of spontaneous moment in the story. But I think there actually can be. It's just that it happens end the outlining process for him. Mm-hmm. It doesn't happen in the actual writing of the story, but it happens in the creation of the story, which he's already done in great detail. So I think there are so many ways to approach the writing of a story. And you just kind of have to learn what your strengths are and what process is going to work for you as a writer. So I'm kind of shy about making any sort of blanket statements about using formula or not using formula. I think there have been a lot of great stories told both ways.
We need to develop a formula for what makes a formula acceptable. I think. No, I think that what Douglas brings up is so perfect, because the mysteries are, that's like almost like screenplays. In other words, they are, what I understand is that those are, there is a pretty tried and true formula for what makes a mystery work. So that's a really good example. And I was just thinking of like sonnets and sort of other literary forms that have fences around them. And I was just thinking about how interesting limits are in storytelling. Like if it's subconscious for us thinking about being hospitable to kids, like that's a fence, you know, that's limits. So it's funny when you asked about sort of baser instincts, I think all of us were kind of like, well, or like that doesn't, when you're thinking about writing for kids, that's just not that's not there, but that is a fence. There is a fence there. And of all the things that we're capable of doing or telling in stories, like, and I think that I think there's so many interesting things. I think we are so fascinated. Our cultural religion is so fascinated with edginess and transgression and think outside the box and all that. We think of creativity as going beyond the bounds. And I think there's something fascinating about like the edge of the map and, thin places. And I think that's always fascinating in sort of in a romantic, healthy way. But there's also so much, I mean, we think about just about marriage, like marriage is this sort of gate. It's sort of this limit. But it's a voluntary limit. That's probably the most celebrated romantic sort of element of life for any kind of literature or creativity. Like people that love, romantic love that culminates in marriage is this something that's been celebrated for generations and should be. It's wonderful. And it's sort of this big picture about the big story, capital S story that sort of echoes and harmonizes with reality. So I think fences and gates and limits are super interesting for characters. Like we don't like characters that are omnicompetent. We like characters that have limits. We like hobbits more than we like Superman, I think, or I do.
Yeah.
And so I just think that could be true of storytellers too. And maybe like I'm just thinking, being convicted, especially as Doug was talking, that maybe my own convictions about this are small, and that there are probably some gates, like somebody like maybe Agatha Christie, if she was on here, she'd be like, no, there's a formula and it works and it's awesome and people love it and it's great. Maybe she would say that. I think that sounds like something she would say.
It does. And the sonnet is such a great example. I do think there are a certain way of formulating storytelling in, say, sitcoms and some certain kinds of popular fiction that really are limiting. But I guess I would say that those kinds of formulas are a good place to start. I mean, sometimes, and I don't know if we're talking about constraints and formulas, are those the same thing? The constraints are so incredibly important and so incredibly helpful. And if you've ever watched a movie or read a story that was free from all constraint, for crying out loud, it's just completely unreadable. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, grammar is a constraint. If you don't follow the constraints of grammar, are a way for us to communicate with one another. And I mean, you know, grammar broadly speaking, you know, and so all those constraints the only way we can connect with one another is through constraints. We say we have agreed that you know, the English language, if we speak English, we agree to use these words, and we're not going to use made up words, or otherwise we're not going to communicate with one another very well. Mm-hmm. And so I'm definitely pro constraint. And when we speak of it in terms of formula, it's hard to get as excited about that language.
Yeah.
But constraints, yes, give me constraints all day long.
Hmm. Think inside the box. That's my that's my new catchphrase.
It's a great one.
Hmm. Hey, so this is a slight detour, I suppose, but I think it's still related. How do you know, like, how do you pursue an idea? So when an idea comes to you or strikes you or begins to interest you in some way, what is it? What is the process by which you're pursuing that idea and beginning to think of it in terms of as more than just like sort of a concept or an idea, but to begin thinking of it as a story and kind of begin wrangling it into something and chasing it? Doug, how does that work out for you?
I don't know if this is true of every story that I've started, and I've certainly started several times as many stories as I've finished writing. But there seems to be a pattern that when I initially jump into the writing of a story, I give away an awful lot on the first page or two. Especially if I'm writing in the voice of a first person narrator to the story. So there's, you know, as a writer, I don't know how it's all going to fit together, but I already know that there are, you know, these several things that are going to happen somehow, that the story is going to go these places. So then it's a matter of continuing to chase that down, being able to maintain the voice of the character, which is something that I sometimes stumble with if I get interrupted and have to leave the story for weeks or months or in some cases years, and then come back to it, trying to get back inside that sort of instinctive sense of how the character communicates. But there's something that I don't even know why, I haven't tried to articulate it before, but that I just love about a character just kind of initially saying so much in broad strokes that then the rest of the book is going to be going back and filling in all the details and connecting those big dots that the character has just given. And if I think about it, I suppose that it probably is an instinct that I tend to approach the beginning of a story that way, if it is a first person narrator. And I probably don't do that if I'm writing in the more detached, omniscient narrator, third person voice.
Do you see that as like creating a problem for yourself so that you can solve it in an interesting way?
Yeah, I think that probably is a huge part of it. But I think it's also something that gets me excited about the story in the same way I would be if I was a reader reading that first page, because I don't know how these things are going to play out. But, you know, I have these 3, 4, 5 major plot point kind of things that have been thrown out there, and now I'm going to have to figure out how to connect those dots, how to bridge those elements in the narrative. And I guess for me, that's a way in. Maybe it's kind of like a someone hunting for gold, digging a number of different holes initially to try to find, okay, where do we actually put the entrance to the mine and spend our effort digging into that. I don't know. That might not be a good analogy, but I just watched The Ballad of Buster Scruggs last night. Just in my head.
That's probably my favorite of all those short films. The minor one. So is there a point at which you know a story or a setup or a character is worth turning into a novel or something longer? Like, I mean, or even just a completed short story? Or is it just something that just kind of just happens and then you look back and you're like, well, I guess this should become something real, or I just did something real?
Yeah, I think what keeps me going beyond those first few pages in a story is probably when the character begins to feel real. I begin to care about them. And I've had, well, there's a story I was working on a few months ago. That was actually one I started years ago, but had set aside. And I returned to it and realized that part of the problem with it was that I didn't care about several of the characters yet, that I didn't know them well enough to care about them. And that was a hindrance to trying to write the story. So, you know, I had written a number of chapters previously, but reached a point where the story just kind of faded off in several different possible directions, and I just didn't know how to pull it together. So I think that's at least a partial answer to your question, is that when the characters begin to feel real and I begin to care about them, including, and maybe even especially, those characters who are, you know, who are going to make destructive choices, who are the bad guy, as it were, in the story, that, you know, I recognize that as the writer of a story, I need to be emotionally invested enough, even in a character like that, that I lament the choices that they make in the story. And so I think once you reach that point with your characters, then you kind of have this sense that you just have to keep going to find out what happens to them.
Jonathan, let me go over to you. So let me ask the original question and then the follow-up at once. So how do you pursue an idea? And then at what point do you know that that story or setup or character is worth sort of is worth turning into something longer, like a novel or whatever? I think that's how I asked it. We'll say.
Yeah. I think I can answer those together. You asked them together. I think I can answer them together. Doug has put it in terms of character. I think I would put it more in terms of a problem, which I think is a language that Sam used a minute ago. You know, I'm looking for a problem that seems big enough and hard enough to solve that it's worth writing about. And so if it's a big problem, it might be big enough for a novel. And if it's a little problem, it might be just, well, there's such thing as too small of a problem, of course. But I didn't know how to answer that question when you started asking it, but I think I would put it in those terms. So, you know, early in 2019, I'm going to start writing the sequel to The Charlatan's Boy, finally, after many years. And, and I've got a problem that I've been just turning over my mind for, I guess, 7 years now, trying to figure out how to solve that problem. That is the central problem of the story. And I still don't quite know how I'm going to solve it, but at least I feel like I've got a direction to go in. And so I'm ready to finally sit down and write this thing. And so, like I said, if it's a problem that is hard for me as a writer to solve, that feels like maybe it's worth writing a complete story or novel about. And if it's not an especially hard problem, then it's not worth writing. I think of it in those terms rather than in terms of character, the way Doug was talking about.
Sam, is one of those two things true for you, or is there something completely different?
I think that they both feel really true. And I guess for me, I feel like listen to Andy Crouch was at Hutchmoot in Nashville this year, and he was talking about how sometimes he was talking about a church setting, but he was talking about how sometimes artists or what we call sort of artistic type people sometimes have their sort of antenna up in a way that other people don't. And he talked about how they're often aware that something's wrong with a culture or something before other people. And I think that's true to some degree. I would also add, which I don't think he said, that sometimes they're wrong about what the solutions are, but they often write about what the problems are, which seems to be true a lot. But I feel like I have sort of that little bit of a net up about some things, but I think about it particularly about ideas or stories. Like I feel like there's a sort of involuntarily, my mind is just kind of going all the time. I was always like a little boy who sort of couldn't go to sleep and, you know, was just sitting and thinking about things. And sometimes that's, you know, on the bad side, that's like worry and anxiety and fear and doubt and all those things. But on the positive side, it's got this sort of creative and generative, and in best case scenario, it's hospitable and for me, I feel like I've always, you're talking about chasing down an idea, like I feel like a kid who's sort of out in the forest of life, so to speak, and like finding a wounded bird, and you kind of like put it in the box and bring it home and like take care of it, and I feel like that, and then, you know, you don't know what it's going to become. Is it going to be okay? And I feel like I do that a lot with different ideas. I'll sort of like, oh, that'll occur to me, and I'll kind of be excited, like, oh, that's, ooh, what if he's like that? What if this character is doing that? Or what if she decides to do this? Or what if this happens? What would she do? And so those are like all these little sort of ideas, and I kind of will write one down, or I'll, if I have my phone with me, I'll kind of email it to myself in like all caps subject line, like, what if he's a traitor? Or what if he's actually this or something, you know, something like that. And it could be a story idea, sort of plot, or a problem, like Jonathan was saying, or it could be like a character thing. And I feel like I just sort of take those home and take that little bird home and kind of take care of it. And sometimes they just die, and that's okay. Because who cares? It's just a bird. Sorry, I got lost in the story there for a second, but no, sometimes it grows. Sometimes it flies away like limping. And sometimes it's like, oh my goodness, what did it become? It's just incredible. Wow. That's the thing I really care about. And so I feel like sort of like that, I've kind of just got some attention. And I thought that was normal, that people were always having like thoughts all the time. But I think that is a little bit maybe peculiar to people who end up like not being able to resist the allure and amazing life of storytelling.
I thought you were going to say the people who couldn't. Right.
Exactly. Yeah, I was thinking of that cliche that like if you cannot do it, then if you cannot be a writer, then don't, by all means. But if you can't help yourself, then go ahead. And I just feel like, yeah, I'm probably one of those people that just can't help himself.
Well, one of my favorite questions for writers is right on those lines. So is writing for you guys, and Sam, I'll go back the opposite way. Sam, is writing for you painful, or is it something that just kind of, for the most part, it tends to flow once you do it? Or do you feel like you're like the last thing you want to do is sit down and try to wrangle this into that something functional?
I could overly complicate this, but I think because I feel like this, I've had so many different experiences of this, I feel like generally speaking, probably it's fair to say that I think that starting is hard. It's like, I am an introvert and a homebody. And, if I go travel to do like a author event or something, like I don't, this might be heartbreaking for people to hear, but like, I don't want to do that. that scares me. And I don't, you know, as far as there's a big part of me, like very naturally, like my physical person, the chemistry of me is like, that's not like, I'm not jumping out of bed. Like, yeah, I get to talk in front of people like that. It's not, but when I'm in the middle of it and I'm doing it after I've gotten over and I'm talking, I think, oh, maybe this is viable. And I'm looking at a little kid's face and they're listening. I think, oh, I have something to say to them that might actually matter for their whole life. And I get kind of into it, because of that. And I sort of have to stay connected to sort of, again, going back to that hospitality thing, like that's where you get a lot of meaning. And so I don't ever want to start, but once I'm into it, I think, oh, this is valuable. And I feel the same similarly about writing generally. It's the most unnatural thing in a lot of ways for me. And for, I think, a lot of writers to like, to, to just sit down and do it. We all want to like do social media and like do other things related to it. Things that are easy, things that are somewhat related, any kind of, if you've read The War of Art, and the resistance will promise you everything if you'll just not sit down and write. And I think that's true. But I also think like if I'm in a rhythm, like when I was talking about my last big book, Ember Rising, like I that was soon after I quit my job. And so I was able just to come like every morning and write. And I was at that, during that, I was loving it. And I was excited to get back into it. And I couldn't wait, 'cause those problems, like wherever we left off, I was like, oh, how are we going to, so I've had every experience, but it's almost always, there's some kind of big barrier. And then when I'm in, I love it so much when I'm in it, and time just goes by and I don't know what's going on. But the main reason I love it is because it's a break from me, not because it's like this self-actualization or anything. It doesn't feel like that at all. It feels like, oh, I didn't think about myself for 3 hours there. And I was totally lost in this world. And it is so relaxing. Like I don't think of writing as relaxing, because it's sometimes hard on your body. It's sedentary and it's difficult to get into, but there's this sort of mental relaxation of getting lost in this story that doesn't, that you're not thinking about yourself or how you're coming off or how you, all these things that you worry about, or I worry about. And so I, in that moment, it is pure joy. And it's the same kind of joy that I think a reader has. And that's where, I think Douglas described it as sort of, instead of you dragging the story along, you're kind of chasing it. And that's how it feels to me. It's just exhilarating, and it's so fun, and it doesn't feel like work. It feels like, oh, I could do this forever. So I feel like it's both are true. Like, it's impossible. I hate it. I never want to do it again. It's awful. I can't. And then it's also completely exhilarating and wonderful, and it's an escape, and I love it. It's fantastic. I don't know if that makes sense, and I can't even remember what your question was, but that's my
no. I think you got it, Jonathan. What about you? The pain of writing.
Yeah, I find it very painful. And as Doug, as Sam said, sometimes it's very exhilarating. And I'm not an introvert. I don't, I'd like to be out, talking to people, drinking coffee and that kind of stuff instead of sitting at my desk. And I can only go into that cave because there's no good way to write except to be by yourself, best I can tell. And I think you have to be alone in a quiet place. And the only reason I can go into that cave is because I know there are people outside the cave who love me or who need what I can make in the cave. And so it's hard for me to do it. I find it easier than I ever have now, but it doesn't come naturally to me. It's one of those things where this is my gift. I know that God gave me these particular gifts, and it would be a shame not to use them. And I do absolutely love connecting with readers. I like, having a product that I can say, here, I made this for you. Mm-hmm. So I love that part, but actually sitting down and writing is usually very painful for me. And then there's that exhilarating part where you're, as we said, it kind of gets away from you, chasing the story instead of pushing it along. And then it makes up for all the pain. So like Sam, I have all kinds of different experiences, but probably the most common experience is, oh, do I have to sit down and do this today? Hmm. Which sounds very ungrateful, because I'm very thankful for having the opportunity to write, when it's done, but actually sitting down and doing it is often not always fun to me.
I have a follow-up question for you, but I want to hear if Doug expresses something similar. Doug, what about you?
Yes. My experience would be similar in a lot of ways. I'm very intimidated by the prospect of sitting down and trying to write something, and will do almost anything other than that. I'll have a day mapped out where, okay, I'm going to write today. I'm going to work on this story. Then I'll spend the next several hours just with one little diversion after another. And oftentimes they're things that need to be done, but it's a fight. And I think it's because the act of writing for me is something that I experience as forcing me into very close proximity to my own insecurities, to the fear that I'm not going to be able to pull this thing off, that I'm going to go to that well and find that it's dry, that I'm going to spend time working on something and the whole is never going to be more than the sum of the parts. So I think there's actually something that's often very humbling about writing, because it forces me to confront and to be so aware of my own neediness and my own deficits and my own inability. But there are also times that once I'm in the midst of the flow of writing, that I have by some means crossed that barrier of intimidation and insecurity, and, you know, for several days have really been inside a story and in the flow of it, that it's like being in a different, in a different dimension where time moves differently, and where I had never thought of it in the terms that Sam described, but that lack of self-consciousness, I think, becomes a very real and exhilarating kind of thing. And in those moments or those stretches of time, of days or weeks, when writing is really just flowing and the story is happening, and it becomes more effortless, to the point that when I finish something, I think, oh, I should be able to output several novels a year. You know, I'm just going to stay in this place now. But inevitably, I mean, that has never been the case, because inevitably I finish something, you know, turn my attention to the things that have to be done in my life, the details, the taking care of, you know, whatever it is, contracts, marketing kind of things, just let alone, you know, just the parts of life and family and actually living as a person among people that take you out of that space. And then I'm right back where I was, where it's so intimidating that I can go months without making any real progress on fiction writing, because it just becomes as intimidating as it ever was to try to find a way back into that process.
So and that forgetting about self that y'all both talk about, that, you know, it's, I agree. It's such a, that's really, I think that still comes back to what we're talking about being surprised, about being beyond yourself. That self-forgetfulness is, it's pretty, I mean, I feel like people who are writers are pretty self-aware. That's part of the reason they do it in the first place. And yet that self-awareness and self-consciousness is so debilitating, and it's so great to be free from it. And so it's not a coincidence, Doug, and I mean, I think it's what you're getting at anyway, that productivity you were talking about, that sort of when you get in the flow, it's also when you've completely forgotten about yourself. And and in my teaching of writing, it's you know, so much of it has to do with helping people forget about, stop thinking about themselves and think about the story or the reader or anything besides themselves.
It's funny, this is basically becoming a commercial for all the young people who might be listening to it and be like, do not do this. Like, they're like, they sound miserable, but it is so, that is a wonderful, that is a really a transformative kind of experience. And I would just say, like, if you haven't felt that, then probably the closest thing I can think of to that, the equivalent of that in my experience has been like sometimes, in like during worship, like that when you, if you've had a religious experience where you really have somehow gotten out of yourself and I'm not even talking just about sort of like a exuberant experience or anything, but may not just if you're just focused on sort of the bigger picture, the bigger story or something, and you just like have forgotten about yourself in those moments of, I think that's the only other area of life I can think of where I just, where I'm just not, where you think I'm focused on wholly on the other, and it is really, really special.
I imagine that great athletes probably get in something, I guess, when they talk about the zone, like a basketball player.
That's another one. Yeah, you're exactly right. It was funny because I haven't played sports that often, and I've been trying to play basketball recently, and I've forgotten how that is exactly what it's like. It is so much like that, where you're in, if you're in a big game, and it's amazing how little, you know, you could be the most self-conscious person, but fearful person, but, you know, I can remember times in college just thinking like, I'll take that shot. That's fine. Like, ball's here. I'm here. I'm going to take, you know, and you just get in this sort of, you forget what a worthless little person you are, and you just get caught up in this moment. And that's true. I forgot. Yeah. Sports. That's another one. Yeah.
So I was going to mention that I have a follow-up question, and we're almost done here. I just have a couple more questions. So this follow-up question, and then two rapid fire questions, hopefully for you. So I know I've taken too much of your time already, but how do you persuade yourself to endure this? So you talk the sense of like discipline, you have to discipline yourself to sit down and do the work, and you're not, unless you do the work, you're not going to get into that moment where you lose yourself. I mean, it's like the athlete, right? Unless you put the work in, you're not going to get into the point in the basketball game where you can successfully sort of get into the zone. So how do you, and that's a negative way of putting it, but that's kind of how I think about it for myself. But how do you persuade yourself to sit down and do the work and be disciplined enough to actually do the writing? Douglas, I'll let you answer that one first.
You know, I guess I would have two parts to my answer. One is that I frequently fail to do that.
Well, now I'm encouraged, so I feel better about myself.
I have good intentions every morning that, you know, by lunchtime start to fade. But there are, I think a couple of years ago, I shared with Jonathan a little trick or life hack that a writer had posted that I had tried and found that it actually did work pretty well for me. And that was, you know, the idea is that you sit down at your computer, you set a timer for 1 hour, and you give yourself, you don't have to write, but you can't do anything else. You can't check email. You can't, you know, get up and exercise. You can't do anything else. Your choice is either to sit there and write or just to sit there for an hour. And when I actually implement that little exercise, I find that it usually works, that once I've, you know, artificially, yes, but once I've set those parameters and narrowed everything down to that one choice, then I'm going to start writing. And then at the end of that hour, you reset your timer for another hour. And so I think for,
you go to the bathroom and then you...
Yeah, you have that option in between. but I think I sometimes need that kind of artificial structure to prime the pump, to force me into that space where I'm being productive as a writer. And then after a couple hours of that, frequently the timer goes off and I just sit there and keep writing for another hour or two because, I no longer need that structure. I'm now inside the story and experiencing that intoxication of the lack of self-consciousness and just wanting to capture the ideas that are spinning in my head at that point. So yeah, for me, it's kind of an extreme based thing, I guess. Either I get nothing done or I have to be very intentional about creating a structure for myself and being my own disciplinarian in that sense.
Sam, what about you? How do you make yourself do it, so to speak?
There are probably two motivations. I think Doug's talked about a a method, but if you pull it back a little bit to sort of motivations, then on the less noble side, it would be like, this is my job and I have kids that need to eat. And so I've got to like show up. And I think I don't think that's all that lacking in nobility, but I think I've got to work. I've got to do this work because this is the business I'm about. So it's sort of this first province of my stewardship in life to take care of my family. I've got to do it. So I've got to show up and work. But I think my better instincts are motivated when I do think about sort of the kids, and I have a little office out that's just sort of detached from my house. It used to be like a little garden shed. And when I come out here to work, the way that I have it oriented, which I won't go into the whole thing, but some of the kids who are reading these stories, the kids whose letters are piling up on my desk, they are pretty prominent in my mind, and I think about them. I care about them. So I try to sort of orient myself a little bit toward them and think about, sort of pray for them, like what they're, you know, and other things too. But so that often does sort of fuel my desire, because it is amazing to me how quickly sort of the less noble motivations sort of fade pretty quickly. Like it is amazing how uninteresting being trying to be famous or even having just like a little taste of that. It is amazing how boring that can be, you know, like how unfulfilling, maybe that's the way to say, like a lot of things that you think will be somewhat fulfilling, even in small doses. So I have to kind of get back connected to sort of like a little bit of a deeper thing. And so at my best, I'm thinking, oh, I want to do this because there's a kid out there that's waiting. And it's nice to be doing a series where kind of getting repeatedly reminded that people want the next,
they're literally waiting
and they're young, and it feels like 1,000 years to them. Each day to them is like 1,000 years. So I feel like sorry for them, and I want to be motivated. So I think, I want to be a pro, you know. I want to show up. I want to do it because it's my job, and I want to do a good job at my work. And then sort of genuine compassion and interest and care for trying to give kids something that they want. Those probably are the two motivations that keep me going through. But yeah, I, like the other guys, it is so challenging to get there anyway. It's difficult. Hmm.
Jonathan.
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to answer the question exactly like, Sam and Doug did. Doug's technique I've used before. It's really helpful for me. So there's one technique. And then very similarly, and I've told this story on probably one of your podcasts before, David, so I'm sorry. I tell this story all the time. I was just going through this horrible case of writer's block back in 2008, 2009, somewhere along in there, and was way behind on my delivery date for The Charlatan's Boy. Hadn't written 100 pages yet, and was way behind. And I just got an email from a reader who said, "Hey, I really need this book, and I wish you would write it." And it sort of took me out of this death spiral of thinking of my writer's block as this little personal tragedy, you know, and realized that there are other people. Yeah, I'm not really doing this for myself. And I mean, actually, I was doing it for myself, and that sort of pulled me out of it, you know. And just being pulled out of myself by remembering that for whatever reason, the work I do matters to people. That makes it possible for me to write. So,
and just to riff on those ideas that Sam and Jonathan brought up, I think the biggest shift for me in the last few years, that has in general been very helpful in motivating me to write and liberating me to write, is that there was a shift from this sort of desperate sense that, oh, I have to write because I want to be a writer, which means I have to write. I have to keep writing stuff. I have to get stuff published, to coming to more of a place of consciously writing as a means of serving a specific community. And all of us are involved on some level with the Rabbit Room and the wider Rabbit Room community. And which, for those who don't know, Rabbit Room is a nonprofit organization. And the mantra of the Rabbit Room is that art nourishes community and community nourishes art. And there is something very liberating about coming to see your creative efforts as a gift you have been given in order that you can serve other people through them. And I think for me, there has just been a night and day kind of shift over the last few years. Once I quit being focused on myself and my own, you know, desperate attempts to become a writer, and really began to try to figure out what sorts of things I could write that would serve this community. And then by extension, I think typically if something serves one community well, then that community becomes a part of extending that thing beyond that community. And, you know, it stands a chance of serving people well outside of that community.
I have, man, we could talk about that sense of writing for a community for a long time, but we don't have time to do that. But I do have two kind of final, hopefully rapid fire questions
for you. Hey, David, can I stop you just real quick? Can I say one more thing about that?
I just feel like it would be
generous for maybe people to hear writers who are struggling too. Is that I think another big, blockade running device for writers is to give up on the idea of perfection. And I know we hear that a lot, but like to be able to ship before it's ready. There's lots of little cliches that people use in this sort of community or startup or entrepreneurial or author sort of communities. But like if we are dedicated to perfection, then that is a paralyzing for me. So giving up on the idea of perfection is very, very important as well as a way to sort of like get through the pain.
Okay. Well, I was just going to ask if you have one single piece of advice that you would give to young writers or storytellers. And so I guess that qualifies as one.
Oh man. Okay.
But if you have something else you'd like to add,
Jonathan,
that actually is a good one. So you can add another one though. Jonathan, as a writing teacher, let's say that you're talking to not to adults, because I mean, these will apply to adults as well, but a lot of, given that your writing is for middle grade readers, if you had a young reader who was kind of beginning to feel like they might want to be a writer when they grow up or already dabbling in that as a young person, what advice would you give them? If you could just give them one piece of advice.
Only one piece of advice, I guess, just, you know, pay attention to the world around you. That's really where the action is. We're, as writers, we're just trying to depict reality. And so writing is every story I've ever written has come from something I've seen somewhere in the world, and occasionally in stories I've read. But I would say, make sure you read a lot, except the people who want to write already do read a lot. And so since you've already read a lot, now also pay really close attention to the world around you. The way people act, the way trees grow, just, that's the advice I would offer. It's not earth shattering, but that's what I would offer.
Doug, what about you?
I taught a creative writing class for a couple of years to high schoolers several years ago. And if they left the class with one takeaway, the thing that I that I tried to impart to them was the notion that writing is rewriting. That that your what you're trying to do, your craft becomes that what separates what they were doing from what a professional published writer might be doing is really about the attention and the number of hours that they would be willing to put into it, most of which is rewriting. I know when I was younger, I would spit something out onto the page, first draft, but I thought it was done. And I thought it was brilliant, and how dare anyone mess with it? And it was a painful process of years to come to the point of realizing how well those things might have had a kernel of inspiration and something in there to be polished, that there was necessarily that process of learning to polish something and repolish and repolish until it was what it needed to be, as opposed to just that more self-indulgent fit of inspiration. So I think, I guess what I'm trying to say is that writing truly is a craft. And there, that requires a devotion to and attention to, a willingness to make the sacrifices of time, and mental effort to do that crafting, that first draft is just a lump of clay. It's like, okay, you've put something physically out there, but now you still have to do the hard work of learning how to shape that thing. So that would be my biggest piece of advice, is just, for young people who want to write, is to cultivate that mindset that this is going to require something of me. It's going to cost me something. First drafts do not tend to be great, and that you have to be willing to weed through, to lose a lot of things that you thought were precious in your first writing of them, but that just don't serve the work as a whole. So, I feel like I'm starting to ramble now, but.
Well, Sam, do you want to add anything to that? That you, besides, don't strive too much for perfection.
Yeah, I would. I think this kind of goes hand in hand with what Douglas is saying. I think both of those, even what JR was saying about seeing the world, is, I think both of those things are oriented towards other people. So, you know, instead of sort of everything we see becoming about us or something, there's sort of like, it's fuel for sort of how we relate to the world. And then, Doug talking about that, is a way of being generous, because it's not just self-expression, you know, it's a generous storytelling. So, but yeah, I would add one thing that Zach Franzen told me one time, and I think it's just was really helpful, and I think would be helpful to anybody, particularly young people coming up. But and that is this: being is better than seeming. Being is better than seeming. So there's so much energy that we can put into, maybe it's a particular temptation of the young, but there's a lot of periphery, a lot of excitement about the idea of being an author. I want to be known as an author. I want to be known as a writer. And we get really, really worried about, am I allowed to call myself a writer? I haven't had anything published. Am I allowed to call myself an author? You know, all these kinds of things and like that. And do I have the look? Do I have the right hair dye or perfect messenger bag, or like, do I have the look and do I seem like an author? Do I seem like a creative? And that's where we get terms like, you know, I'm a creative. Oh, what are you? I'm a creative. Or, you know, these sort of like snobby kind of ways to distinguish ourselves. And I think some of that, and I'm not saying that's bad, all of it. I really don't even, I don't think that. And I actually don't even care, like, you know, what kind of bag or what kind of, you know, hair dye or whatever you have. Like, I don't, that doesn't matter to me. I'm not saying that's wrong. I'm just saying being is better than seeming. Hmm. So what happens when you actually, you know, what writers do is they just write and they read and they have like cool things about them and nerdy things about them. And so don't sweat it. Like, if you want to be a writer, and being is way cooler than seeming. Mm-hmm. So whatever energy that you have, that's like, oh, I'm going to get my, you know, I'm going to get my website to where I look like a writer. Like, that's fine. That's good. Obviously if you're a writer, you want to do, you want to do that. Or I want to, you know, I like these kinds of jeans or kinds of whatever, like, that's fine. But I think what you find when you actually meet actual people who are real storytellers, they don't always fit. You know, sometimes they don't, they're not good speakers, for instance, often, because they're good writers. they're not maybe always great at being in front of people or something. They might not dress exactly the way you think, you know, but being is way better than seeming. So I think just, if you have energy to put into something, just put it into it. And what's cool about that is what happens when you actually do it is that you seem like a writer too, because you are. Mm-hmm. So you kind of get both in the bargain. But I would put my energy into being, if you can, instead of seeming.
What kind of messenger bag do you wear?
Well, this is how much I believe this now. Like, I just gave my the messenger bag I had, which was leather, which I wore for years, to my son. Oh, okay. And I use like an Adidas backpack, because it's like so much more practical and it's easy to go through airports and stuff. So I don't even have a messenger bag anymore. That's how committed I am to this thing. This Adidas backpack looks dumb, but it does the job.
All right. Hey, so for each of you, what's the last great thing that you've read? Tim, since you had the floor there, I'll let you go first, and you don't need to, you know, for the sake of our listeners, we probably should wrap this up, but you can just give.
they've been through enough. I appreciate your sensitivity to them. We've done enough damage. So I am always sort of rereading the Master and Commander, the Aubrey Maturin series. Yeah. And I'm reading that probably for the third or fourth time now. And I'm on book 8 or 9 or something in that.
Wow.
It's not always great for young kids. It's not free of the baser things sometimes, but it's, mostly it's a really noble series and I absolutely love it.
Doug, what's the best thing that you've read lately?
Not too long ago, I read Gilead, the book by, it's Marilyn Robinson, right, Jonathan?
Yeah. Okay. That's right.
Just a quietly stunning, beautifully written book. Her feel for the language and for the personalities of characters. It was just remarkable. So.
It's a great book. My only problem with Marilyn Robinson is she doesn't like Flannery O'Connor.
Didn't know that.
Yeah. I just read Brian's Head Revisited for the first time.
Yeah,
loved it.
We've done a whole series of podcasts on both of those books. Yeah. Probably like 6 or 7 episodes on each of them. So can't say we've done it on Master and Commander, but we probably should now that I think about it. Although that would take a long time with all those books. Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me. This has been enlightening and quite interesting. And I'm grateful that you were willing to share a little bit of your Friday morning time with me. You probably should be writing right now, but instead you're talking to me about writing. So maybe I'm doing you
a favor. This is so much easier. This was so easy.
Well, thank you to SD Smith, Jonathan Rogers, and Douglas McKelvey for joining me in this episode of Libromania. To learn more about S.D. Smith, head over to sdsmith.net. To learn more about Douglas McKelvey, head over to dougmckelvey.com. And to learn more about Jonathan Rogers, head over to jonathan-rogers.com. All those links will be posted in the show notes, so be able to get easy access to them, to see all the spelling and all that kind of thing. Thank you so much for listening to Libromania. Please remember, subscribe, rate, review. We really appreciate all your support, and we really appreciate when you help us spread the word to make more episodes like this possible. Don't forget about all the other great content on the Close Reads Podcast Network. We have our flagship show, Close Reads, discussing novels. We have The Play's the Thing, discussing Shakespeare's entire canon, one act at a time. And we have The Daily Poem, which is an audio anthology brought to you each morning, featuring some of the greatest poems ever written. Thank you for listening. This has been another episode of Libromania here on the Close Reads Podcast Network. I'm David Kern, looking forward to talking to you next week. Happy reading.